cover a topic that's before the legislature in Madison, that being teacher training and teacher licensure. And I would like to, I would imagine that it has some connection with some other issues, similar issues such as teacher evaluation and compensation. With me today are, first of all, Steve Urso. Steve has had wide experience in this field. He's been executive director of the Kenosha Education Association, and he holds a doctorate in educational leadership. Karen Sconsert is associate professor of education at Carthage College. And Scott Farnsworth is a recently retired teacher. Did you spend all your career at Reuther?
Almost all of it, all in Kenosha.
And now he's a published essayist on various subjects of regarding education. Let me begin by quoting from an article that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal earlier this week regarding standards. It's two paragraphs. Read, standards for licensure in the field of education are largely identical in the United States and in high-achieving countries around the world. Earning a bachelor's degree, taking rigorous courses within one's discipline, studying developmental psychology, curriculum design, pedagogy, and assessment, and being mentored by master teachers provides teacher candidates with knowledge and skills required to begin their teacher's career. These expectations should be neither partisan nor controversial. Yet in the wee hours of the morning recently, while most Wisconsinites were sound asleep, a motion was introduced and approved by the legislature's Joint Committee on Finance. For all practices, the motion eliminates nearly all of the existing requirements to obtain teacher licensure in Wisconsin and teach Wisconsin students 6th through 12th grade. Who would like to be the first to respond to that? We were talking before the program, Karen.
I would like to kind of put it into context for people to say that this is certainly not the first and probably won't be the last time that we have some kind of disagreement over teachers and teaching. There is a long history of that in the United States. I have been reviewing, just in anticipation of this program, a really excellent book called The Teacher Wars. The author is Dana Goldstein, and the subtitle is A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And if that sounds a little bit over the top, it's actually not. It is, it's a really excellent, well-articulated book, very easily accessible to anyone, where she reviews basically all of the issues around teaching in the United States over the last 200 years. And we have had sort of an ongoing battle over what makes a good teacher, whether teachers are born or made. All of these things kind of cycle around for us in a way that really isn't happening as much in other countries. People have, you know, set on this idea in other places that teaching is a profession that requires a lot of preparation, and that that preparation should be based in research on how children learn and how adults learn and continue to get better. Yes, there are some natural born teachers, but they probably aren't suitable for every situation at every time. So that's one place I would start.
And I think that's a really excellent point. I think that most people called to the profession of teaching feel a natural draw. And I agree with you. I think there are people out there who have this perception that people are born teachers, and therefore they're just naturals. And I think to a certain extent, people who come into the profession have that natural ability. But there are, and I've always said that teaching is an art, not a science. But if you look at the great pianists in history, if you look at the great violinists in history, they have a certain natural gift that brought them to that profession. Didn't mean that they didn't go to get on to get instruction. Didn't mean that they didn't go on to gather skills from people who knew the craft so that they could, in fact, rise to their full potential. And teaching, I think, and teacher education is a very similar process. And so people can be born to it. It doesn't mean that they can just go out and do it.
yeah, you have a vocation to teach. Mm-hmm. And then, as the Jesuits like to say, your vocation requires formation, and that's where the education requirement comes in. And the controversy that Karen referred to is one of the things we would probably agree that makes teaching such an exciting and challenging profession, one of them.
It's a real challenge. And one of the issues here, I think that the saying, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, is very applicable to what the policymakers in Madison are trying to accomplish. A couple years ago, they were very concerned about student test scores. They were very concerned about student achievement and trying to fill in the gap in student achievement. But now it seems that that is gone to second place, and now we're talking about the person standing in the front of the classroom who arguably may be the most important component of student achievement. But yet they want to change the requirements for what that person should or might do, and they're going to talk a lot about really dollars and cents. So we're right back where we kind of started about 4 years ago, before the election of Scott Walker, having this conversation about what's in the best interest of public education.
And I think going on with that idea about who's in front of the classroom, one of the things that I find most upsetting about this proposal is Wisconsin's history in terms of teacher preparation and licensure. I just had a colleague who was unfortunately looking to relocate and applied for a position in California and came back to say absolutely no problem getting a position in California because of the respect people have across this country for a Wisconsin teaching license because of what they know about our licensure process and the qualifications that a person has to meet in order to get that license. And so we have had traditionally in this state not only a well-recognized public education system, but a universally well-recognized teacher preparation program. And that's all getting thrown at risk by this proposal, because it's not going to take very long, I don't think, for people across the country to say, oh, you're certified from the state of Wisconsin. What does that mean?
That's a really good point. Carthage, being located in Kenosha, right on the border with Illinois, we actually have many, many students from out of state, a lot from Illinois, but also the other Midwestern states. I have a student from Colorado who is back teaching in Colorado. And it's true, it is one of our big selling points is to say this license is easily transferable to another state. Sometimes you have to fill out some paperwork or take their test or something like that, but people do respect the license and they know that it's a good one. So that is an angle that I hadn't really thought of quite in that way. So it's interesting. Maybe we'll have to start offering Illinois licenses in Carthage. I'm not speaking officially in that. I'm just speculating, making a joke.
Well, as you were saying that, I was thinking about the fact that we have, if the listening audience doesn't know where of it, we've started a Facebook site for this program to make it somewhat interactive because we can't take calls on the air, and we don't really want to do that. But people can chime in, and we can we can post things on and have to do with breaking news or things that we find. I was checking this morning, and the post that has gotten the most likes and reaches is one from that I picked up off of the Los Angeles Times site. It was an analysis by their education reporter of the what he felt were negative trends in education, controversial issues nationwide. And he chose as his bellwether state, Wisconsin, because Wisconsin had the highest standards because Wisconsin was so highly regarded. And so he spent about a third of the article talking about what is happening in Wisconsin. And that's an indication of what you say. One of the things that is most destructive of teacher morale, and I've seen so many teachers leaving in the last several years that I didn't see when I first came here, is the fact that they know they're professionals, but they aren't regarded as professionals by the community, and the public officials are feeding that belief.
Well, while I understand it, I don't know that it's just public officials. I think there's a perception out there that's been passed along by all these reports and media exposés, so to speak, on there being bad teachers, there being teachers who are being kept in the system. The thing that I always keep hearing about, and I read a lot in the New York Times, is about the rubber rooms that they have for the teachers in New York City, where they just put the bad ones in there, and it's kind of like this abyss where they just sit there forever and ever. I've been in this business for about 25 years, and I think that maybe on any given year, I've had to deal with approximately 2% of the teaching population on matters where it was determined, or it was at least alleged, that they were incapable of appropriately educating students. I don't think that's the kind of problem that we should be worried about right now.
I can add a statistic to that. So
good.
This is coming from Dana Goldstein's introduction on the Teacher Wars book. In 2007, the last year for which national data is available, 2.1% of American public school teachers were fired for cause, a figure that includes tenured teachers. Compared to federal workers, who one study found are fired at an annual rate of 0.02%, teachers are exponentially more likely to be terminated. There is no comparable data from the private sector because the Bureau of Labor Statistics groups layoffs with firings. But in 2012, companies with over 1,000 employees, the closest private counterpart to a large urban school system, lost only 2% of their workforce from firings, resignations, and layoffs combined. In short, teachers are more, not less likely than many other workers to get fired. That is really completely counter to the narrative that we have been told. So I guess what I would urge listeners to think about, in addition to reading this really helpful book, is to ask themselves, so why is this the narrative that's being pushed? Why do we see on the cover of Time magazine a rotten apple?
Mm-hmm. And that same sentiment was echoed by the speaker, Jamie Vollmer, that was brought in by the CABA organization during Education Week, had the public forum at Indian Trail. And he was from a business background, initially a critic of public education, but he made the same point. He said one of the biggest problems with the legislation coming out of Madison is that they are passing legislation as though the problem with public education is a personnel problem. And he said, it's not. It is not a personnel problem.
It has nothing to do with that, Scott. I mean, this is an old conversation, an old, old, old dialogue. And it started with property tax relief. And it was all this conversation about how property taxes are too high, and the biggest draw on property taxes is public education, be that K through 12 or the University of Wisconsin system. Now, we don't have to hash over what's going on with the University of Wisconsin system. Just remember what Forrest Gump says, stupid is as stupid does. And cutting the University of Wisconsin is about as dumb as you can get. But let's move to the real topic at hand, and that's perception that the property taxes are being spent inappropriately. Well, who's the straw man in all that? It's the teacher. Because that's, you know, we've heard for years, when the school district comes out with their budget in September, or their preliminary budget or whatever they're calling it these days, that 85% or 80% or 75%, whatever magic number they want to attach to it, is related to teacher costs for salary and benefits. Really? Okay. In turn, what's the graduation rates? How does Wisconsin compare to Mississippi? How does it compare to Texas? What are the standards that are used for teachers in other states? And let's talk about Minnesota. Let's talk about Illinois, and let's talk about Michigan. Is it comparable? No. Wisconsin's are higher. Always have been, and hopefully will remain. But we have policy interfering, policy decisions interfering with student development in education. We're on two separate tracks at the same time. Yet we have those people who want to say, well, this is really about property tax relief. This is an old conversation. Okay, Governor Thompson had this huge idea of reform and how we were going to do this and we're going to do that. You may all recall that for a long time we talked about just raising the sales taxes and dedicating or restricting certain amounts of the sales tax just for public education and taking public education off the property tax rolls. How well did that work? I don't think anybody ever brought it up again after it was brought up the first couple times. So at the heart of all this, I think, is this perception out there by the public that my property taxes are not being well spent in the schools. And I think you have to call a spade a spade. That's a flat-out lie.
Well, I'd agree with that, and I don't understand why. And again, maybe there is no understanding required in this regard because it is perception. But I've never understood why property taxpayers who believe that their property taxes are too high don't recognize equally that their property values are tied directly to the quality of their public schools in their community, because nobody is going to, and you brought this point up when we were talking earlier, nobody is going to invest in a house in a district that has recognized to have a poor public education system.
I would just like to zoom out a little bit and say that this issue of blaming teachers is not a Wisconsin-specific thing. This has been nationwide. It's been, you know, as the book that I keep referring to says, the teacher wars have been going on for 200 years. But it feels a little different to me this time in some ways because there's sort of two things going on. At the exact moment when this proposal comes up to just eliminate certification entirely, the previous 4 years we've had two giant tests added on to our teacher certification program here in Wisconsin. One at the behest of the governor, a reading test for our people who are being certified for elementary school and special education. And it's a standardized test that they have to pass in order to be able to get their certification. It costs a lot of money. It's administered by a big education conglomerate not based in the United States. There is another one called the EdTPA, which is a performance exam developed out of Stanford. I would say as standardized exams go, it's probably one of the best I've seen, but it basically replicates the process that we already do with our students and their supervisors when they're student teaching. Rather than just have the supervisor watch them and see that they're doing well and analyze their lessons and sit down and ask them why they did what they did, they now have to write all that down and send a video of themselves, again, to a large conglomerate that's based outside of the United States and pay extra money to do it. So it's really interesting to me that these two things are happening at the same time. At the same time, we started giving teacher tests in the 1990s. Teach for America started to rise, where basically they just give 5 weeks of training in the summer to college graduates that they think are going to be good teachers. And so we have more and more and more requirements coming from the states and the federal government on one side, and then let's throw them all out and do nothing.
Yeah.
And it's, again, not only happening here. When I lived in New Jersey in the 90s, there was this very controversial alternative certification program in New Jersey. And this kind of thing keeps happening on and off all the time. And I think you touched on it earlier when you said, we haven't really decided what we want here. And that is, when you go back and you look at these sort of bigger studies, policy books, look at history, that is part of the issue. We haven't really decided what we want.
It's a huge problem in this state for us to grapple with this whole idea of funding public education, because we've never really addressed how to do it. We all agree that the system is flawed. That is not I don't think it's a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian issue. We haven't figured out how to fund public education. And that, in turn, creates a lot of anxiety out in the general public, I believe, and creates a lot of misunderstandings of what the roles are. I mean, I think if you sit back and you say, okay, you've worked in the private sector for a number of years as an accountant, you can come in and teach math. Really? Okay, so what are you aware of the dynamics in the classroom? Are you aware of the racial differences that now exist in many of the urban school districts? Plus, are you prepared to deal with the special needs students? And how do you plan to do that? What tactics are you going to use? What's your long-term strategy? I don't envy people coming in without a four-year degree, without maybe even a master's degree. We have a history in this state of compensating people more for them embellishing their education, for them attaining higher grades. One of the things that struck me, Mike, when I was thinking about this when you first talked to me, was, you know, for years in the labor contracts, which we can't have anymore, there was salary grids for teachers. But in it also now exists for, or it used to exist for, public employees in general. And it was based on two concepts. One, educational achievement. Two, length of service. And you moved along the grid. Well, this is another way to get rid of the grid. And if you wanna talk about what's at stake here, public education is about a $4 trillion enterprise in this country. And I'm sure that there's a few stockholders out there, shareholders, in private corporations that would like to have access to that. But there's this other little problem that we got. We still haven't figured out where we're going.
Yeah, the grid system is criticized by people who don't understand why the grid system worked in producing good teachers, because they think that, and we encounter this all the time, they think that all teachers are tenured, that they're never evaluated, that they have jobs for life, and that just getting a degree gets you to a salary. When in fact, when we were under the grid system, the teachers who were there the longest had been going through evaluations during this period of time and had been acquiring skills in working with teachers. And getting higher grades, higher pay scale for getting a master's degree, for example, really did produce results, does produce results. But I know teachers now who have decided that they aren't going to pursue an advanced degree because they're afraid that their job will be given to someone right out of college with a bachelor's degree, because they can be paid less. And now we're talking about not even requiring that license.
Right. Well, and essentially you have people who are, I've had many people tell me that they see absolutely no purpose in pursuing a master's degree, because essentially funding has been cut so much that districts cannot afford to compensate teachers for extra education. I don't think Kenosha's unique in being in the position of having had to freeze people where they were on the salary schedule 4 years ago or 3 years ago, because they simply cannot afford to fund the traditional grid salary schedule. And so folks are saying, why would I invest tens of thousands of dollars in a higher in a master's degree when there is no prospect of compensation for that down the road.
And again, to just sort of put this in larger context, so we don't actually have a lot of for-profit charter schools in Wisconsin. Most of our charters are run by districts, and the teachers are paid comparably to those who are in the regular district schools. But if you go to the states where they do have a lot of them, Illinois is one, Ohio has tons of for-profit charters. So the average teacher salary in Ohio for a regular public school teacher is about $50,000. So that's the range from beginning to end of career. It's not a ton of money. But the charter teachers paid on average $36,000 a year. So what happens to that additional $14,000? Well, there are shareholders that need to be paid. And also administrators and charters tend to make a lot more money. One example of this is the urban prep charters in Chicago, which you may have heard of. There are three, four, five, I'm not sure, but there is a sort of a chain of for-profit charters. They're actually not for-profit, but the leader of that charter network, it's paid the same amount as the superintendent for the entire district of Chicago. You know, so for overseeing three or four schools, they get a couple $100,000, and for overseeing the entire Chicago school district with 400,000 students and over 500 schools, you get the same amount. So, you know, I think one of the things that's really interesting to me about this sort of whole debate and issue here in Wisconsin is we have some really complicated language that we have written into the statutes and whatever to describe our charter. So we have, and I'm trying to still track down where this comes from, we have instrumentality charters and non-instrumentality charters.
Right.
Why are they called that? Why don't we say district run or independent or for profit? We don't use those words because then people might understand maybe what the difference is. So, you know, those of you who live in Kenosha and Racine, the charters that we have mostly are district run. I think 21st Century School in Racine is not district run. It's affiliated with Parkside.
Right.
But the rest of them are district run. So K-Tech and Harborside teachers are paid just like other teachers. So you, when you go in there, you will see teachers of all ages. Whereas if you go to some charters, Milwaukee has a number of independent charters. And they often have a lot of very inexperienced teachers because they can't pay them enough and still be able to pay their principal enough to attract them, or to pay if they have a superintendent of their chain of charters to attract them. So sometimes having really young teachers is a fabulous thing, but there is a need to have some folks around who are, you know, who have some long-term experience. So there definitely is money involved in this. And then again, to think about, well, what do you think is best for your children? Do you want them all to be taught by beginners or not?
Well, what do you think, Karen? Do you think we could take a major corporation and just throw out the CEO because we don't want to have tenure and we don't want to have any kind of seniority or anything like that? Just put an ad in the paper and say, we'd like you to run Yahoo, but you're going to have to do it without any training and without any kind of backup or any kind of support. And by the way, we're going to pay you $20 million to do it. Now, do you think you'd get an applicant for that? I bet you would. And there's no prerequisite, I mean, other than the fact that you're walking, talking, breathing, and, you know, and I'm being very simplistic about it, but think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You said, why do we use these terms? Why do we use these words like accountability and measurement and all this kind of stuff? Well, they're business terms.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of
they use instrumentality and non-instrumentality? I still don't know where that came from.
Not a clue, but it sounded good.
From a movie, Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
It sounds good. So,
yeah.
You know, but look, I think there's a place for charters.
Mm-hmm.
I truly
I
do. I also think you can't just eviscerate the public schools and expect that somehow they're going to be able to produce a better product than they ever did before. So if the game is just to make them look bad and force the issue so that you have more charters, there's a byproduct of that, and it's called damaging the students. And at the heart of all of this are the students, because that, I'll use a business term, that's the product. And what we do with that product is critical to our future. But it doesn't seem to be catching on, and that kind of logic doesn't seem to be apparent in Madison, because they have a systemic belief that public education only works in certain school districts. It's not going to work in them all. And we're going to divide and conquer. I mean, we kind of remember that term, don't we? So we're going to divide and conquer, and we're going to figure out who we can dumb down, who we can underfund, who will go away. Well, look at where the charters will probably end up. Look at where the voucher schools probably are. Are they in the rural areas? I mean, is there an alternative? Yep. Up in Ladysmith? No. Is there an alternative over in Potosi? No. But there will be in Beloit, Madison, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Appleton, Wausau, really. How did they vote? They vote primarily for the conservative right-wing agenda as it relates to public education, or are they more middle of the road?
Well, if you look at the map, they're middle of the road, according yes. to the electoral map. So.
And politics, again. There was a time, Mike, when you couldn't have policy in the state budget, but I guess we forgot about that, too.
Right. Attach substantive stuff to the budget, and people will vote for it because they don't want to throw out everything else that's in the budget. We've been talking here, and we've all done a lot of thinking, trying to rationalize and dissect and identify the reasons why the public has the views that it has about teachers and about education. And I think that it has something to do with the economics of the last several years. People have been through rough times, and they tend to look for people they perceive as being better off,
right.
as being at fault. I'm reminded of the movie Network, if you've ever seen that. Frederick March is an aging news anchor who's about to be put out to pasture. And at the end of a half-hour newscast where he's been reading nothing but bad news, he stands up behind his podium, behind his set on television, raises his fist and says, I'm mad as hell and I'm not taking it anymore. Who's responsible? And he becomes a national phenomenon, and everybody starts looking towards other people that they perceive as better off as themselves and blaming them for whatever problems they have in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had this conversation with people where they said, well, we've had to pay more for our health insurance, so they should too. And I can see where that's coming from. I totally understand where people would feel badly about it. But making other people earn less money does not make you earn more.
No.
You might get a few hundred bucks back on your property taxes, maybe, but your wages are not going to go up if other people's wages are going down. And I think one way to illustrate this is our teacher education major numbers are down, as they are all over the country. So this isn't a Wisconsin-specific thing at all. But our enrollment numbers at Carthage are not down. So people are still going to college. They're just not going to college to be teachers as much as they were before. So they will be going into other professions. So maybe someone who would have been a math teacher will now be an accountant. They'll be in the job pool to become an accountant. So if there are more people trying to become accountants, does that make the wages for accountants go up or down? It makes them go down.
Should.
So one of the things I tell my students who are going through our program or recent graduates, I say, hang in there because the pendulum has to swing the other way. We're going to have a teacher shortage. It's already starting. And at some point, they're going to need to hire you, and you'll be able to sort of design the workplace in the way that you'd like it to look. And we have these conversations all the time. If you could, what would teaching really look like? How would you vision your career in the mid-career stage? But you can't assume that just because someone else has a hard-earned benefit or wage, that if you somehow get it to go down, that yours are going to go up. It's just going to drive everyone's wages down. So,
which is the way things have been going for decades in this country. Absolutely. I want to pick up on a couple of things. Steve brought up the charters and also talked about the fact that as a state we haven't decided where we want to go. I think that the charters are an indication and the voucher system is an indication that some people have a very definite idea of where they want the state to go in terms of education, and that this new licensure proposal is part and parcel of that whole process, because you talked about the fact that there are a number of inexperienced people working in the voucher and charter schools in Milwaukee who are making less money. Also because those private charter schools have no requirement to hire certified teachers. This licensure law, if it passes, will provide an avenue by which those privately run charter schools can go out and advertise themselves as having all state certified teachers on their staff, even though their personnel has not changed in any manner, shape, or form, nor have they acquired any additional skills or education in being teachers. And I believe for all of the talk of rural districts' difficulties in finding staff, which I'm not denying is an issue, I don't think that's the real motivation behind this proposal to lower the standards on receiving a Wisconsin teaching license. And the finances and the fact that teachers are finding themselves making less money. One of the other things that is being created in this whole process is instability. And one of the most important and crucial factors in a good school system is stability in the staff. It makes no sense, for example, to invest in professional development, which we all have been told repeatedly is very, very important. It makes no sense to invest in that if you're having a continuous turnover in staff. And why are you having a continuous turnover in staff? Well, you're having a continuous turnover in staff because when districts are underfunded and cannot give their staff salary increases, the only way for those teachers to earn more money is to leave the district they've been in and go to a different district that will take them in as a new employee, ask them what level of experience they have, and move them up the salary schedule to that level of experience where they were frozen before. So it creates a situation for districts that will make it very difficult for them to develop their staff and create a culture in their district, because all of that requires a stable workforce, and that's disappearing.
So are you suggesting that teachers, like all other workers, actually respond to the market forces around them?
Absolutely, and that's why
you're... If we're big trusting in the market, then I think by sort of deprofessionalizing teaching and or paying teachers less, you're basically creating a market crisis.
Absolutely. You're creating, and of course the state, the legislature has not just created this instability within the public sector. Now they've gone and created it within the private sector as well. And I was reading an article in the New York Times Magazine just this past weekend, and apparently now, in addition to our abysmal job creation numbers, Wisconsin has risen to be in the top 10 of states that people are leaving. So, yes, response to market forces, absolutely.
If I had more resources, it certainly would be interesting to make a comparison of our border communities, the ones that are on the border with Minnesota, and I guess to a certain extent Michigan, although there's not much population there, but certainly with Illinois, and just sort of see what exactly is the flow of people and of teachers back and forth across those borders. Because we're not in isolation. You know, people don't even have to sell their house to go work in, you know, Waukegan. They can just drive there.
And yeah, I would be sad to tell you the number of conversations I've had with teachers in Kenosha about that very fact.
So as we approach the time to wrap this up, I would say that I suppose we've all agreed that in our searches, we have not been able to find any positive educational reason for the so-called reforms that are being attached to budget bills and things in Madison right now. I, in working for on the Facebook site, Seeking Balance, have tried to find anyone from an education background who has something to positive to say about this. And when Mr. Voss was interviewed on the radio recently on a Milwaukee television station and was repeatedly asked about this, about reasons for these various initiatives, he never answered any of those questions, despite the fact that Mike Gouche asked him several successive questions. He would constantly answer a different question that hadn't been asked.
Making him a politician.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, you bring up an excellent point. I mean, the rural administrators for whose districts this law, this licensure law is supposedly written, have come out against it. They have no interest in it. Their concern is the removal of the caps on the voucher programs and what that will do to their funding. So when you even look at the districts that are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this law, everything the legislature is doing, as far as those superintendents are concerned, is counterproductive.
And again, I would say this is distressing, and for a lot of people in Wisconsin, a new thing. But this is not a new thing in the history of education in the United States. We, you know, schools tend to be our battleground in all different ways, from everything from religion to science teaching. And this is another one of those ways. But I do think that there's some reason to be concerned because we don't have a national system, and we here in the listening area do live on the border of another state who have a different system, who fund their schools differently. And for all that we hear about the crisis of funding in Illinois, there are still a lot of school systems that pay very well. And so I am very concerned about this as a parent of a student here in Kenosha. What is going to happen? How are those classrooms going to be staffed if there's a much more attractive option for people just over the border? So it's a really interesting thing, and you know, I feel like we're having a giant experiment. But on a personal level, my son is one of the guinea pigs in this. So,
well, I'll just close with a few lines from this editorial in the journal. It says, "We care about quality. We care about equity, which includes access and the ability to be successful. We believe the children in our state are worthy of the highest quality of education. We welcome and embrace the highest standards possible for teaching in the state of Wisconsin. And we believe every child in the state should be challenged and supported by a quality system." And with that, I think we'll have to wind up our we've used up our allotted time. You've been listening to a conversation about teacher standards and licensure with Steve Urso, Karen Sconziger, and Scott Farnsworth, and me, your host, Mike Kehoe. I'd like to remind you that all EM programs are archived on the WGTD website, and that is in connection with these broadcasts. It means that we have developed a companion Facebook site which is sort of intended to give you an opportunity to participate interactively